Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we look at the cultural construction of disabilities. We'll look at rare disabilities, like deafness, and also at much more common disabilities, like gray hair on women. I hope you'll stay tuned. John Milton wrote Paradise Lost, an epic poem of some 12,000 lines of iambic pentameter. And I produce New World Notes, to compare great things with small. I have read Paradise Lost in its entirety, and I have listened to every single installment of New World Notes in its entirety. I am probably the only person on Earth who has done both. I don't normally compare Paradise Lost and New World Notes. That is to compare great things with small. But that phrase has stuck in my mind. The phrase to compare great things with small. The phrase itself is from Paradise Lost. Milton just tosses the phrase out as he is comparing Satan with the Roman goddess of war. I didn't know the Romans had a goddess of war. Must have been Mars's girlfriend. You can just imagine the fights they'd have. Cute couple, had some issues. As it turns out, her name was Bellona. Remember that name, the Roman goddess of war, Bellona. That will be a good nickname for President Hillary Clinton. Hillary will doubtless feel compelled to prove that she's just as tough as any male Republican. Anyway, unlike Bellona, Milton's phrase is still well known, to compare great things with small. And yet again, that's what we will do today on New World Notes. The main topic is disabilities and disabled people, so-called. We'll hear a fine short talk on the history of disability by Jess Wright. She shows that whether or not you're considered disabled depends on how productive you are as a worker. As the nature of work changes, the definition of disabled changes. Many people considered able-bodied 200 years ago would be considered disabled today. What happened between then and now was modern industrial capitalism. Here's the even bigger point that interests me. There's a lot of things we consider inevitable, part of nature, not worth protesting. Not even worth thinking about. It's just the way things are. Like, water flows downhill. But many of these things are not natural and inevitable. They are products of a particular, brutal economic and social system. Like widespread poverty. The huge cost of a college education. Medical care dependent on your ability to pay for it. Handicapped people being a burden to society. Women get less and less attractive as they get older than 25. It's just the way things are. All of these things seem so obvious and natural that most people just accept them as givens. But they're not natural. They are artifacts of the system. They are nasty artifacts of the system. The system that itself likes to pretend it is just a force of nature, too. No sense trying to change the system. It's like gravity. Or so the owners of the system would like you to believe. Well, comparing great things with small, first we'll talk about people who are deaf and such. Then we'll take a look at an even more widespread disability. Women who look 10 years older when they are 10 years older. And the foolhardy few who defy nature by deciding not to dye their hair. My local daily news rag has a long story on the subject, complete with warnings from concerned professional hairdressers, warnings that women should not flaunt their disabilities, like looking older than 25. But first, here is Jess Wright on the social and economic construction of disabilities.
The World Health Organization reports that more than 1 billion people, roughly 1 in 7 of the world's population, are disabled, and almost 80% of all of us will experience either temporary or permanent disability through the course of our lives. As with all awfulness under capitalism, disablement happens disproportionately to women, people of color, and the elderly. We know, of course, that poverty increases the likelihood of impairment, whether it's due to chronic diseases such as heart disease, diabetes, and arthritis, occupational injuries, or preventable infectious disease in the global south, like tuberculosis, HIV/AIDS, malaria, congenital defects, etc. We also know that disability further accelerates poverty. In the United States, working-age disabled folks are twice as likely to be unemployed as non-disabled. And in the United States, 44% of workers with disabilities are in contingent or part-time jobs, compared to 22% of the non-disabled. These high rates of unemployment and underemployment mean reliance upon social wage programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which require navigating a tangle of bureaucracy to obtain, and in the case of Social Security disability insurance, routinely require the assistance of a lawyer in order to obtain poverty-level benefits. All of these limited social programs are now currently being slashed and burned in the bipartisan austerity onslaught. Disabled individuals are also exceedingly vulnerable to abuse and violence. 1 in 8 victims of police murder in 2012 was mentally ill or in severe mental distress. Just last week, an Oregon police officer tased an 11-year-old autistic girl walking on the street because she did not verbally respond when he spoke to her. Families who murder their disabled children, and there are a number of these cases, generally get off with few or no penalties in the court system. And although much legislation has been passed to ensure the civil rights and protections of persons with disabilities, as with all civil rights law, the only mechanism for enforcement is via a long and arduous lawsuit, which puts the burden on the disabled person and their family to fight to obtain their rights. So how did we get here? I'd like to briefly sketch out a few historical factors in the development of disability as a social category, which has given rise to these dire circumstances, and also to discuss a little bit about the reform movements and the activism that led up to the disability rights movement in the 20th century. Unfortunately, despite the fact that there's so much fascinating information, I'm having to leave a lot out, so I hope that folks will put out questions. If it's something that we don't mention in the talk, please throw it out in discussion, and hopefully we can address it. So I'm going to start with the colonial period. In the colonial period, physical impairments were common, and they were generally unremarked upon. Missing eyes, missing limbs did not prevent participation in agriculture and small-scale production. And so people with these impairments were not disabled from working in an environment where production was more flexible. Extended families provided support, care, and assistance in adapting labor conditions. In comparison with physical impairments, mental illness and mental impairments attracted much more attention, but only those people who were really violent in their behavior were sent to jails or workhouses. In the late 1700s, almshouses and workhouses began to appear to warehouse those who were economically dependent. Those sent to workhouses were routinely treated to lashings and physical abuse as a form of treatment, and those who were least capable of working were thrown into crazy cellars. Asylums and educational institutions for various disabilities began to appear in the early 1800s. A new mode of treatment, called moral treatment, recommended that madmen and lunatics be treated with some sensitivity. No restraints, no physical punishment, no bloodletting. A philosophy of rational, kindly care and withdrawal from the world was said to help the distressed to regain their reason. In the first decades of the 19th century, Samuel Gridley Howe establishes the Perkins School of the Blind, and Thomas Hopkins Gallaudet founds the Hartford Asylum for the Deaf. And so these are the first institutions that start catering in terms of education for disabled populations. But of course, as with many things, they catered mostly to male members of upper-class white families. At the time, women, blacks, and Native Americans were all considered simply by virtue of their biological being to be innately disabled to one degree or another. It was held that women should not be educated, lest it inspire them to insanity or hysteria. Blacks, of course, as part of the rationale for slavery, were held to be racially, mentally inferior, and incapable of anything beyond manual labor. Native Americans, of course, as part of the justification for colonialism, were considered mentally inferior and in many cases incapable of civilized language. With the acceleration of industrial capitalism as the dominant mode of production, bodies became increasingly valued for their ability to function like machines. Those with non-standard bodies were excluded by the standardization and the rapid repetition of factory work. And this created issues of unemployment and economic marginalization. And this is why we talk about disability as being socially constructed, right? Because people with impairments were able to work and be productive in the community before that. Factories also greatly increased the risk of accidental impairment by powerful machinery and hazardous chemicals. Extraction of mined resources led to epidemics of silicosis and black lung, and the crowded, unsanitary conditions in the rapidly growing cities led to more diseases, which killed large numbers, but also left disabled survivors. The dissolution of extended family networks, as people were drawn into waged employment, left people with impairments with no social support, and the economic necessity to work for a wage meant that those who were previously capable of contributing labor were disabled by the conditions of production and the demands of industrial capital. With an increase in the demand for literacy, also, this number of impairments also increases, because folks who had mild intellectual or developmental issues wouldn't have even been recognized prior to this point because they were working in agriculture or craft production, and now they start to be excluded from certain types of work. The horrors of the transatlantic passage, the brutality and forced labor, and the poor living conditions of slavery enacted a tremendous physical cost in terms of the impairment and disability of black bodies. Disabled slaves were termed as refuse slaves, and they were resold at low prices or they were abandoned. Native Americans also suffered from European diseases and violence, which killed or impaired millions of people. So you start to see, increasing numbers of impaired people. In the mid-1840s, the number of asylums and institutions expands rapidly. Progressive reformer Dorothea Dix conducts a high-profile campaign exposing the abuses of the mentally ill in the prison system, leading to public funding in a number of northern states for insane asylums. Legislation at this time first provides legal definitions of the insane and imbeciles to differentiate them from the general prison and workhouse populations. Around the same time, Samuel Gridley Howe opens a facility for intellectually impaired children, then known as idiots, as an add-on facility at the Perkins School of the Blind. So we start to see the labeling and the medicalization of disability at this point. So impairments are seen as treatable, curable, or fixable. Disabled persons are the objects of pity and charity. In this period prior to the Civil War, these asylums were seen as cutting-edge treatment. They're providing education, rehabilitation, and also some employment in what were known as sheltered workshops, which were intended to teach vocational skills that disabled people could then hopefully translate into employment in the community, which, as we discover later, doesn't actually pan out. Institutionalization as a social response to exclusion from labor was and continues to be a tremendously significant structural factor for disabled folks throughout the 20th century. The various wars of the 19th and 20th century would also have a tremendous impact on the disabled population. Huge influxes of newly disabled people, medical and surgical innovations from battlefield medicine, and the increased production of prosthetic and mobility technology would arise in the periods of these bursts of technological innovation, the periods coming right after the Civil War, right after the World War I, and right after World War II. Disabled soldiers were first provided medical and rehabilitative care after the Civil War. Congress passed a pension program for Union Army veterans with disabilities. The program required eligibility screening based on medical evaluation, and disability was defined as an inability to work. With this legislation, the medical model of disability becomes enshrined in law, and we see this hallowed tradition of bureaucracy, gatekeeping, and the denial of resources to the disabled. The Civil War exacerbated the social and legal hierarchy between military disabled and civilian disabled, with a disparity in access to resources. I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit. The demand for labor in the World Wars meant an increasing employment of the disabled at home when non-disabled workers went abroad to fight, with significant increases in the Second World War. Goodyear and Firestone hired deaf workers for their Akron, Ohio plants during World War I. They provided sports facilities, dance halls, and social clubs for the deaf community. Their experience was so positive that the two companies continued to recruit deaf workers even after the war. Unfortunately, this was happening only in small pockets during World War I. During World War II, close to 200,000 disabled workers found jobs. The War Manpower Commission conducted a major media campaign to educate the public on the capabilities of disabled workers in an effort to remove social stigma. This situation points out the social construction of disability. When capital has no need for reserve labor, people with impairments are excluded from working. Discrimination based on the profit motive is the key barrier to employment, not any functional limitation on the part of the individual. When capitalism has a use for impaired bodies, it finds accommodation, especially when it's in the service of mass murder. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, there were tremendous developments in prosthetics and wheelchair technology, investigations into stainless steel, titanium, etc. And another situation that spurred further development in terms of assistive technology and mobility technology were the polio epidemics, which happened every year basically from 1916 through the 1950s. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, himself a polio survivor, founded the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation and the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and these institutions collected tremendous amounts of money to improve the iron lung, which helped polio victims survive, and also to develop new, lighter, more portable ventilators, wheelchairs, and braces. They also put a bunch of money into the vaccines. The huge numbers left disabled by polio altered the image and status of disabled people, and a number of leaders of the early disability rights movement were polio survivors. So these are some of the big picture factors. I'd like to talk a little bit about the sort of seeds of organizational consciousness and the sort of awareness of the necessity to fight back within disabled communities at the end of the 19th century. The deaf-mute newspaper appears in 1849. The silent worker newspaper appears in 1888. Both of these served deaf communities. So we start to see print media coming out for these communities. The residents of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum published a journal called The Opal from 1851 to 1860, which then became the inspiration later on for the anti-psychiatry and parts of the deinstitutionalization movement later on. They were an early liberation movement for mentally ill patients. They were writing very interesting things at the time. Louis Braille had invented his print for the blind in 1829. But we also see at this time this increase in the number of social organizations and institutions for the disabled because they're obtaining increasing levels of education and vocational training. In 1864, Congress legislated the creation of Gallaudet University. After significant lobbying efforts by Edward Minor, Gallaudet, son of Thomas, you start to see organizations such as the New York Blind Aid Association, the American Blind People's Higher Education and Improvement Association, the American Professional Society of the Deaf, and in particular, the organizations for the deaf form part of the context for a really important controversy around the issue of oralism. In the 1840s, hearing educators for the deaf began to advocate for the elimination of sign language, which had previously been the dominant mode of instruction for deaf people. Oralism was the belief that the deaf can and should communicate exclusively by lip reading and speech. They believed that sign language impeded the social integration of the deaf and that the deaf population was resisting assimilation. This was occurring at a time when the American economy was expanding with a growing industrial sector. There were large waves of immigration and labor competition, which were spurring sharp racial and economic conflicts, and the upper classes really feared ethnic and linguistic diversity. So the accusations toward the immigrant communities and toward the deaf community of resisting assimilation were cast in the same language. The clubs and associations and schools that were dedicated for the deaf community mirrored those of the non-white ethnic groups, excluding white people. Social Darwinism at this point, you know, had a great appeal to rationalize and explain why social inequity was a natural phenomenon, and biology was, of course, misused to argue that heredity in terms of race and genes would prevail over class and economic issues. So this spurred fears over disabled reproduction, and it was used as a continuing justification for the segregation, the warehousing, and the discrimination against disabled people. In this context, oralists warned that the deaf would become foreigners among their own countrymen, and no gesturer can become an American. So part of the fight back against this was the National Association of the Deaf. They organized in 1880. They defended sign language as the natural language of the deaf. They argued that eliminating ASL would be educationally disastrous, which it was. And they also lobbied against eugenics and defended the rights of the deaf to marry, have children, and share full citizen status. But the horrors of social Darwinism and eugenics were only just beginning to unfold. In 1909, Indiana passed a law for the compulsory eugenic sterilization of convicted criminals and the mentally impaired. And we start to see these acts come up. In 1914, Harry Laughlin, superintendent of an organization known as the Eugenics Record Office, drafted the Model Sterilization Act, which were then used in the Virginia law in 1924, and most notably in Nazi Germany in 1933. The language of Laughlin's act was taken almost wholesale and used by the Nazis in the law for the protection against genetically defective offspring. It covered 9 supposedly hereditary conditions. Over the course of time, in Germany, it was used to sterilize 400,000 people. Globally, it was used to sterilize 15 million people. And in the United States, from 1920 to 1970, laws based on these same ideas sterilized 65,000 people. And that's something we don't hear about a lot, you know, the United States piece of that. You know, maybe we'll hear about things like the Tuskegee experiments, right? But you don't hear about the wholesale sterilization of the mentally impaired in the United States in the 20th century. Some states still to this day permit sterilization of the mentally impaired without their consent, either under court or family agreement. So the strong presumption remains that disability disqualifies one from parenting. So, you know, really, I had to exclude tons of information here, and I apologize for that. I hope that we can take some of this up in the discussion. I've tried to just touch on some of the historical issues and trends that inform the social category of disability and condition the demands for the disability rights movement today.
Just right. Speaking in Chicago, June 27, 2013. Thanks to WeAreMany.org for the recording. And thanks to Robin Upton for acquainting me with that talk. Robin produces the radio show Unwelcome Guests, unwelcomeguests.net. Our strategy today is comparing great things with small. And our theme is disabilities, which raises the old question, what's with American women? I mean conventional middle class and working class American women. They go to great effort and use all manners of chemicals to remove every single hair on their body below the earlobes. And they obsess over the hair they have left on top of their head. What's that all about? I am a refugee from the late 1960s, and I take all of this personally. Apparently, some few women have been deciding that God, Gaia, nature, and their own bodies know best. And when their hair starts to turn gray, they will let it. This is considered a bold and risky and unwise decision by the corporate newspapers, not to mention all the hairdressers, chemical companies, and drugstores that advertise in the corporate newspapers. So we have a long article here explaining that failing to dye your hair is a perverse, unnatural act. It is an act of folly that will make you look not just unattractive, but old. Let me read parts of the article. It's called Shades of Gray by Kim Hone McMahon. Some women dare to ditch the dye. Silver or gray is trending now in fashion, accessories, and home decor. And while some local stylists say going gray naturally may be a trend, others say it can make a woman look 10 years older. I have one client with gorgeous white and silver natural hair that I wouldn't color if she asked me, said Jackie Parker, owner of J. Parker & Associates in Green, Ohio. Most gray hair, though, is not pretty. Unquote. Letting gray grow out is a long process, explained Tina Pestian, a stylist at Georgie Salon and Spa in Fairlawn, Ohio. It's a journey, that's for sure. Both Parker and Warner, another stylist, understand why clients are interested in at least exploring their gray roots. Quote, it is freeing, less maintenance, and a more simple lifestyle. It goes along with everything we are doing now, said Parker. But unless they are one of the rare women with that silver and white mix, I tell them, if you want to look 10 years older, then stop coloring your hair. Jackie Karras, owner of Creative Designers in Portage Lakes, Ohio, agreed. You can't convince me that it's a good thing to go gray, unless you are old. When you are in your 80s and you have pretty white hair, that's one thing. I think gray hair makes men look older, but they can pull it off, she said. It looks more distinguished, but with women, that's another story. And that newspaper story originally appeared in the Akron Beacon Journal, and it was reprinted in my local rag, the Journal Enquirer of No Fixed Address, including a little blurb right on page one that reads, Ditch the dye. Some women are brave enough to let their gray show, and for some it looks good. But stylists argue that gray hair has only one effect. It makes a woman look older. Now, the cultural assumptions bound up in that short paragraph would take hours to untangle and critique. Younger is better, older is worse. Looking younger than you are is better than looking your age. A bottle of cancer-causing chemicals will actually make you look 10 years younger than you are. It really, really works. Honest, no one will be wise to your trick. Everyone will be fooled, even though everyone you know is pulling the same trick. It's good for a 50-year-old woman to look 40. It's bad if she looks 50. As you become older, you become less valuable. Gray hair in itself makes you look older. Light brown hair makes you look younger. You ought to hate that gray. Hate that gray? Wash it away with Clairol. Well, as I said, untangling that bunch of lies and deceptions and dubious assumptions would take more time than we have. So I will merely plop it all on the table and thank you for listening to New World Notes. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, gray hair and all, wishing you a good week, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and reminding you that maybe you're not crazy, maybe the system is. Ciao.